Greetings from Polymancer, and welcome to episode 10 of the Dicecast.
Episode 10, Interview with Ed Greenwood. Yeah!
Studio for Dicecast at Fan Expo 2010. We had the chance to interview a lot of interesting people, and one of them was Ed Greenwood.
Now, as a matter of introduction, Ed Greenwood is the creator of the Forgotten Realms campaign setting. This is one of the best known and most highly developed game settings for the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game. It's been around in one form or another since AD&D First Edition, so many gamers out there are very familiar with it. In addition to campaign source books, Mr. Greenwood has also written quite a few adventure modules and other supplements for it, innumerable articles for Dragon and Polyhedron magazines, and also a number of novels which took place in the Forgotten Realms setting, most of which feature his signature character, Elminster the Mage. The latest one, released in 2010, is called Elminster Must Die. Now, Fan Expo is an annual convention held in Toronto at the Metro Toronto Convention Center every August, the weekend before Labor Day. It's huge. It features science fiction, fantasy, horror, anime, and manga. This year there were over 60,000 attendees and a guest list that reads like the A-list of Hollywood, quite frankly. And they just happened to have Ed Greenwood there too. So what did you and Ed Greenwood talk about?
We talked about a couple of things. I mean, Ed Greenwood, to be fair, does look a lot like Elminster. Elminster looks like Ed Greenwood. And he's got the most charming personality out there. I mean, he is a very humble person.
That's the thing we were struck by is just how humble and approachable and friendly the guy is.
Well, of course, because he would walk around this crowd and people would be asking for interviews. And, you know, hey, can I get, you know, your autograph? Can I do this? Can I do that? And he just, you know, it took us 30 to 45 minutes just to get to where we actually interviewed the guy. And it didn't even faze him. No, a lot of people can, you know, that stuff can get to your head. Not to Ed Greenwood. Ed Greenwood is one of those people out there that is very humble. I mean, he recognized that he's done a lot of things for the industry and he's written a lot of important things, but it doesn't get to him. I mean, and to some extent, I would say that he's on the same caliber as Gary Gygax, which we interviewed this very same show, and Dave Morrison, which we almost interviewed, and a lot of people in the industry. And so it's very refreshing to talk to people like this who have contributed so much to what we consider to be our background, our industry, and still be very humble about it.
So what did the two of you talk about?
Well, we talked about a couple of things. I mean, obviously the books and Forgotten Realms is number one on the list. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff for that. And very interestingly, what we consider, I mean, maybe most of us as gamers to be Forgotten Realms was not entirely written by Ed Greenwood.
I mean, it was added in by the publisher?
Not quite. I mean, he actually had this stuff written in, but they already had stuff that was written in by other freelancers, and they figured, well, we'll just, you know, take this, replace it with what we already have, and thank you very much for putting your name to it.
Okay, so that would probably mean that, like, when Ed Greenwood runs his own D&D campaign, and we know that he still does to this day, even if it takes place in the Forgotten Realms, it's considerably different from what we know from just store-bought supplements, right?
That was something that was actually interesting to listen to, because the world that we know of Ed Greenwood's, I mean, the Forgotten Realms, is quite different from the one that was actually published. And Ed Greenwood himself actually says that most of the stuff that he actually puts in his own campaign is actually voted on by the players who play in his campaign. So you can sort of see that there's two worlds. There's the Ed Greenwood's world that actually got published, and the world that he's running his campaign, which is quite separate from the one that was actually printed.
Well, it sounds like a great interview, and we're going to hear it next, right after this.
Okay, Mags, you know about the reviews, interviews, news, and discussions that we have here on All Games Considered. But before you join up, we should tell you about the curse.
Wait, what?
Yeah, what's this about?
The co-host curse. I mean, you know, first there was just Mike and his bizarre gardening accident. Poor
bizarre
guy.
Bizarre gardening.
And then there was the first Chris. He choked on...
Mark, what does this have to do with anything?
Well, you guys are going through co-host at an alarming rate.
And it's not going to get better if Mark keeps scaring them away.
All Games Considered, featuring news and conversations about all aspects of tabletop gaming, is a proud member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network.
Start your journey at www.agcpodcast.info.
Let me guess, the second Chris spontaneously combusted during a recording, right?
Yeah, how did you know?
Here we are at Fan Expo 2010. I'm with the legendary Ed Greenwood, who's here as a guest for the Gaming Expo. Ed Greenwood, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how does it feel coming to a convention and having everyone just know who you are and then constantly asking you for interview for drafts, and if we almost didn't make it to this little alcove or doing this interview?
Well, okay, it was exciting 30 years ago, okay? It's really flattering, particularly the conventions. The first ones I went to as a young kid were down in the United States, so it was a long trip, and all of a sudden, hey, all these people who I didn't know, and then year after year, people I did know, because I saw them once a year at that convention, would go, oh, it's Ed Greenwood, wow! And I go, wow, these people know me. But of course, they know me not for me, but for what I've done, for the writing I've done, for the game setting I created, the Forgotten Realms, and the stuff I'd written for the game. So it felt really good, because, hey, these people know and love me because they read my work and like it. So, yes, all good. Now it's sort of like, I'm used to it. It's still fun, but I'm used to it. So that thrill and that oh my gosh, awesome responsibility. You know, wow. You know, and the other thing is, as you get older and less, you know, devilishly handsome, you're no longer asked to father babies. And you get asked to name babies and occasionally marry people. Not you marry somebody, but marry two people to each other. But the sort of things you did in your 20s that were really exciting and whoa, did I get away with that? They're gone.
So with great power comes great responsibility?
I guess, yeah. I hate to say it. I hate to sound like somebody's dad or a judge or whatever, but yes, that's true.
Yes. And so anyway, for people who have lived under a rock and don't know who you are, if that is even possible, unless somebody put a feeble mind spell on them, can you tell us a bio of the life of Ed Greenwood and what you've all the things you've done, and if of all the things that you've done, what is it that you're most proud of?
Well, I'm a Canadian. I'm 51 years old. I've worked in public libraries since I was 14, and I've been a writer and a gamer for at least that long. I started creating a world called the Forgotten Realms when I was 6 years old. I didn't know it was called the Forgotten Realms until I was 7 years old, and I wrote short stories set in that world. It was just for my own entertainment, and it became an official world for the Dungeons & Dragons game with the second edition of the game. And I've written, I think we're 186 books now, both game books and novels and so on, most of them set in the Forgotten Realms, but I write other fantasy books, and I've worked on Middle-earth for computer licenses and so on, and I guess I'm most proud of the fact that The Forgotten Realms has reached out across the world. There are people who know about it everywhere, and a lot of them have become my friends. I think that's the best thing in the hobby, to make friends all across the world.
And how did you get into D&D and the gaming scene?
I started reading a magazine called Dragon Magazine, or The Dragon, as it was then. I started reading it regularly around issue 10. I started buying it monthly at issue 19. And in those days, everybody who was in D&D read Dragon, either secondhand, because your friend who had a subscription passed it around, or firsthand. And there were almost no other magazines, and there certainly were no other magazines on this side of the pond that continued. There were magazines that published for 8 issues or 4 issues or 12 issues and then petered out. But at that time, there was just one main crossroads for the entire industry, and that was Dragon. So that's how I got into it. I had purchased a board game from TSR called Divine Right, and there were things obviously wrong with the rules. Like, Shukasim had X number of armies in the rules, but the counter sheet gave them another 2 armies. And some of the rules in the rule book ended in mid-word. And there was obviously more of the sentence that was missing. So I wrote what I thought would fix these and send it into the magazine, and they saved it for a Divine Right theme issue. At the same time, they had a thing called Dragon's Bestiary, which had been called Featured Creature, where you got to write an official D&D monster, and you got paid $25 US, which was a lot of money to a high school student.
And that was like in, what, the 70s?
Yes, yeah. So I started writing them and sending them off. And the first one they took, Cursed, in issue 30, and Crawling Claws in issue 32. And the Crawling Claws is interesting because I sent it, I typed it up in my typewriter, and I mailed it away. 16 days later, my issue of Dragon came back to me with my monster in it. And I said, wow, they're desperate. They must have no monsters. They just grabbed it out of the mail and put it in print. And I sat down and wrote about 10 of these things. And they made me a contributing editor at the next Gen Con, so they could use my stuff all the time. So I was away to the races.
And what was the first big project that you did that you would say essentially created Forgotten Realms?
Oh, the Realms had been going since I was 6 years old. And I put little Realms details into all of my Dragon articles because I considered it was fairer that way to my players. If it had been published in Dragon and was official, I could use it on them like a monster or a magic item. And they all read Dragon too. But they didn't have the Dragon sitting there at the gaming table when we played. So if they vaguely remembered some detail, the monster or magic item, that was okay because that was sort of like their character might know something in the world. But they weren't cheating by looking it up in the rule book. So I put the Realms into all that stuff. The big articles for Dragon were, in issue 37, I did a Gates article about magic gates, which was not the Realms, it was everything in D&D, and it had footnotes, which so vastly impressed the editor that, oh, wow, footnotes. You know. And then I did the Hells, the Nine Hells for D&D in issue 75 and 76 and later 91. And those were the big ones. But all the way through all of my articles, I'd been putting little Realm stuff in until the time came where TSR wanted a new world to replace Greyhawk and replace Dragonlance to be the setting for second edition. And one of the guys who read Dragon, who was on staff, Jeff Grubb, said, well, why don't we just see if we can buy this world? Because it took us, like, everybody in the company and a year to do Dragonlance, design it in-house. Let's see if some guy's done all the work and we can buy it and just get ahead on that. And he phoned me and he said, do you have a complete detailed world at home, or you just make it up as you go along? And I said, yes and yes. And he said, oh, okay, good, send it. So I did. So that's how the Realms got to...
And I guess that was maybe a couple of years before the actual setting came out. And did you have to? Were there some stuff that they said, well, can you fix this? Or did they all say, well, no, everything's fine? Are there things that the Realms were before it was published, and then they were modified afterwards, like editing and things like that? Is there things that were changed? And in your opinion, were there some good changes or bad changes?
It was 1986 that all this happened, and in 1987 the Realms came out, product by product. By and large, they didn't ask me to change anything. They just finally told me to stop sending stuff because it was filling their offices. I just sent stuff and stuff and stuff and stuff. And they said, oh, gee. You know, finally they said, okay, enough. But what they wanted was the broad-based world. And what they changed to the world was taking away things I'd done, like my Moonshae Islands, and replacing them with a campaign that Doug Niles, who was a staff designer at TSR, already had a sort of Albion, England campaign, in which they replaced my Moonshaes with his Moonshaes. And then afterwards, they added stuff. And one of the things that some of the designers at TSR at that time were very big on was history. So they wanted a sort of an orient, okay? And there were actually proposals floating around inside the company, Arabian Adventures, which became El Khadim, Pirate Adventures, Oriental Adventures, which actually got published as S, Oriental Adventures. And they needed a place to add all these onto the realms, because that's what they bought the realms for, to be the setting for second edition D&D. So it had to have a jungle setting, it had to have a pirate setting, it had to have an oriental setting, it had to have all these settings, and they were all added on. And although I have nothing against that, I always thought it was a mistake in style to add direct copies of our real-world stuff. Because then people stop role-playing characters in a world, fantasy world, and they start thinking about like people in our real world and saying, wait a minute, they didn't have stirrups at that battle because they learned it in history class. You know, and immediately they're not thinking about the fantasy world. They're thinking about real life and what they know about, you know, or what Hollywood told them about medieval times, which is even worse.
Men in tights.
Yes, yes, exactly. And they stop role-playing as characters in the world, and they start trying to apply all the stuff they've seen in movies. Just to give you an example, there's a Cutthroat Isle, which was a pirate movie that came along much later.
Yeah, with Geena Davis and then a bunch of other people.
Okay, remember the bit in the movie where she's trying to escape and she's on top of the coach, and it crashes and she runs through the restaurant and crashes out through the windows and land on top of the coach again? Well, after you've seen things like that in the movies, oh, I'm going to try it in role-playing. And it's sort of like, oh no, as a dungeon master, you can see the train wreck coming.
Or the coach wreck.
The coach wreck coming. You know what they're going to do and you're what they're going to try. And you think to yourself, I really wish they would just behave like characters in the realms, like the way they were 30 seconds ago, instead of stepping outside the realms and they're thinking and trying to do these other things. So in that way, putting stuff that we recognize from our real world, whether it's the Gold Rush or whether it's Marco Polo and the Silk Road or anything like that, is a mistake in style. You should sort of file the edges off and realmsify it. See, my Thay was my as close as I got to the Orient, and in my Thay was a slaving society, and the women were shaved bald like Moondragon on Marvel Comics, you know, and so on. It looked very exotic, but it didn't look exotic that you could say, oh, that's China, oh, that's Japan. I didn't want it that way. I wanted it so they'd still keep role-playing. Like, I don't know what this is like, but these people are different than us, rather than saying, oh, these are Chinese. I didn't want that. You know, I didn't want them thinking the wrong way.
So there are segments of the realm that sort of like never appeared.
Yes, yeah, because TSR plugged in what it needed to. But on the other hand, I knew going in that they were going to do this. This is why they bought the world. And at that time, I had relinquished artistic control, signed it over to them, so they can do what they like. You know, I can't kick about it saying later. I'm just saying I thought personally that was a mistake in style. I wouldn't have done it that way, but I know that the company needed to do it for their own. Yeah.
And but this setting, you were using it for your own games with people you were playing with. Mm-hmm. When the official Forgotten Realms went out, did you continue playing in your version of the Forgotten Realm, or did you start using the version that TSR had published based on the material you'd done?
A bit of both. In that my players hadn't seen a lot of the maps and so on, which I had drawn. Yes, TSR redrew them, but I mean they were essentially the same maps. So we started using some of the components from the published realms. But the main answer to that is no. We went on playing in the Forgotten Realms because, as a dungeon master, I have always thought that I'm there to entertain the players. So if we're going to do something in the realms, like adopt a rule system, for instance, the Bard class changed from first edition to second edition. It changed again, you know. If you have a player whose character is a Bard, then I'm not going to just say, okay, everything changed. We do it by voting. As the Dungeon Master, I have two votes instead of one, but I have eight regular players, so they can easily outvote me. So they voted to decide, oh, are we going to have Bards new way or old way, or are we going to allow a changeover? Are we going to have the Time of Troubles, the Avatar crisis where the gods changed? And they voted no. So in our Forgotten Realms, we haven't had the Avatar. No, we haven't reached the time setting of the Avatar yet, because we, in terms of calendar time, we play really slowly. That's the other thing. After playing with me for 5 or 6 years of real time, they had reached 7th level, 8th level, as characters only. So and we had intensely played in a few days and weeks and then months, not years. So years actually took about a year of real time for a year of game time to pass in my campaign. Sometimes slower than that. We 2 years of real time before a year of game time. So we haven't actually reached the time when the Avatar crisis would happen. Whereas the published realms has raced ahead. And then when it came to 4th edition, they just jumped it a century. But, I mean, it had already raced ahead 30 years further on than my home realms campaign, which is fine. I'm there in my home campaign for my players. So it's what they want. And if they want, you know, their realms campaign to be all playing dancing girls on the deck of some ship, then that's what we do.
Are there some memorable moments from that campaign that you'd like to share, like anecdotes?
Oh, way too many to relate. The thing is, the Realms campaign, everybody role-plays intensely. What comes out of your mouth, unless you say player-to-player or player-to-DM, comes out of your character's mouth. So they're always role-playing. And I had a habit as Dungeon Master of making what goes around comes around, making poetic justice. So there are many moments where they did something that came back to bite them, or came to mean something 20 or 30 play sessions later, and they suddenly go, oh, that key I got, whoa, and they pull it out and it would work. So there's lots and lots of memorable moments, but the problem with memorable moments is, unless they're really slapstick or really unsubtle, it turns into a let me tell you about my character moment, and everybody goes, that's nice. And of course, the reason for that is, when somebody says, oh, it was really great, we saved the world, but you really had to be there. Well, that's the point. You did have to be there, because you have to share in the experiences, because they can't convey to you properly what it meant to them. And they can tell you what happened. Oh, yeah, we killed Asmodeus, and then we took the throne, and then one of us got crowned king. And you go, that's nice, because it doesn't mean anything to you. Whereas if you played through it, you go, wow, you did? Wow, because it really means something to you. And so, yeah, I can talk for hours with anecdotes from the original Realms campaign, but most of them you're going to go, oh, yeah, that's nice, because you weren't there, you know.
It's like basically explaining to somebody your favorite moments in a TV show and to someone who's never watched the first season.
Exactly, yeah. And they go, huh?
What's the funniest moment or the funniest thing that ever happened in the game to you?
The funniest thing? There have been lots of them. There have been lots of the pratfall moments, because Victor Selby, who is a lawyer here in Toronto, played a character called Torm, who was a thief. And Torm is the smartass. You know, he can't refrain from the needling phrase. And he would always get himself into trouble. And usually, because he was also, you know, the lusty guy, he would end up having to flee naked from the brothel, you know, or snatch some woman's clothing from the brothel, put it on and try and sneak past the guards or something. And I would always choose the opportunity for something to happen, like the hem of the dress gets caught on something and it begins to rip down, leaving him embarrassed in front of the guards or whatever. And there are lots of moments like that. And there have been some hilariously funny moments where they're really funny because the players can see what's coming. They start to giggle because they know that it's going to have it coming and there's nothing they can do to stop it. There were a lot of those moments. And again, you know, to convey one to you, you go, oh, okay, Yeah, I guess that was funny. But, you know, it isn't really if you didn't live through it. But there were a lot of moments that were like that, where you know what's going to happen. Like the banana peel that stage center, and everybody runs past it, and you're just waiting for some to slip on it, and people come right up to it, and then somebody calls their name, and they spin around and walk away from it. You go, and then somebody walks right across it, doesn't slip, and you go, oh, and then just when you think nothing's going to happen, you know, the Lord Mayor slips on it, you know, and there's falls on top of somebody, and there's the big There were lots of moments like that.
Well, you mentioned you had a friend of yours who's now a lawyer in Toronto that was playing in the game, and one thing that game masters have to deal with is rules lawyer. Was he a rules lawyer? And
No. The delightful thing about the realms, and the thing that made me detail the realms a lot in the first place, was my characters demanded that level of detail, but they didn't demand it out of character. From the very beginning, they wanted to role play, so I didn't sit down, open a module, as we used to call adventures, you know, a published adventure, and run them through it. They sat there and had a war council in character. They'd say, well, where do you think we should go? I think it's time to pay those louts and Vunlar a visit again. You know, they would choose the adventure, and they would act as their characters. So I never had a rules lawyer, with one exception. There's a hilarious 5-part cassette tape in my possession, from a good old Sony tape recorder. You know those old black ones that we all got in school? Okay, sitting up at my cottage when we were trying to run psionic combat, and we're at the same time as we're running psionic combat between a particular NPC of the Zentrum and a particular PC, there is a military invasion of Shadowdale, and we're fighting this out. We're fighting out this huge, these tabletop battles, and in the background, it's like, but, you know, I don't think Psionic Fortress works like that. So aside from that long ongoing, which is hilarious to listen to because it goes on for hours, well, maybe if we recalculate, you know, aside from that one moment, because Psionics in the original first edition Psionics was a little broken and we were all feeling our way through it for the first time, aside from that, there was never any reference to the rules. They would say things like, if anybody had the tendency to do that, they'd say, but wait a minute, Lightning Bolt is this long, and it takes this many segments. I'd say, how do you know that? Well, my character, how does your character know that? And then they'd fall silent. You're right. My character doesn't know there's something called the Player's Handbook, you know. And I can't look up a spell in the Player's Handbook. And say, well, be that as it may, the lightning bolt that this guy just cast at you did this. What are you going to do? You know, so it was always role-playing rather than rules lore. So I never had a problem with the rules lore. I've had them at Gen Con since many times because I would run tournament tables for charity usually.
And then people would actually play in a game that you're running and then they try to rules lawyer you.
Of course.
Yeah. They have no shame, do they?
No, because you see, there are some gamers who want to role-play, some gamers who want to have a good time, and there are some gamers who got to win. And they got to win by any means they can. They've got to win. And they're not having fun unless they do win. And I usually think that that is a big mistake for everybody. But that doesn't mean that isn't what they do. And they're not going to change overnight. That's what they do. And when you get someone like that, the idea is to make sure that everybody at the table has fun. Not just that guy. So that guy doesn't feel picked on. Okay, because that's bad too. But everybody has fun. So if that guy's taking too much time, as a player, he's talking too much, and the shyer, quieter players aren't getting their... You make sure the shy, quieter players get their moment to shine. Otherwise, they feel like they sat there while some other guy argued with the Dungeon Master for 4 hours. You know, and that's no good.
Now, a lot of people who are icons, like just like yourself in the gaming industry, Gary Gygax, Dave Arneson... have you ever played games with them?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, they're both dead now. I played in an early Gen Con, very early Gen Con, at a tabletop sand table war game, a war game, chainmail rather than D&D, with Gary. That would have been Gen Con 8, I think. I've played a game that I can't recall the name of that Dave Arneson wrote, which was a sort of D&D clone early on. I played that. I think that was Gen Con 17 or Gen Con 18. And then the last few years before Dave died, he would have a booth at Gen Con, a table at Gen Con. He was in a wheelchair, and I would always stop and talk with him. And sometimes we'd role play things for fun, you know, like one room. Okay, you see an arched doorway in front of you, and it's got a carved gargoyle in it, and the gargoyle opens both its eyes and glares at you, and its eyes are red. What do you do? You know, we'd just do the one room like that and have fun. But yes, I've played with all those guys, and almost everybody who was on staff at TSR when I first started working with them, Bruce Hurd, Jeff Grubb, then the later designers like Steve Shand and so on. Yeah, I've played with all of those guys, usually at a Gen Con and usually a charity event. You know, we just DM them or we'd sit in on something. Oh, yeah. I soon learned not to be a player very often at Gen Con, because then there would be inevitably gamers there who just want to kill my characters. They could say they'd killed Ed Greenwood, which was fine, except it ruined the fun for the rest of the party at the table, because usually the guy had given me a vital character who had the magic item or had the spell they'd need at the end of the adventure, and these guys had killed me off, so therefore there was... You know, and the other thing is, it was gentleman's honor. If you won the AD&D Open, and I did early at a Gen Con, I got a best player trophy and stuff, wrapped in diapers.
Wrapped in diapers?
Yeah, disposable diapers. Not used. New diapers.
Why the diapers?
To keep the trophy from getting scratched. It was in a box, and it was wrapped in diapers.
Bubble wrap didn't exist back then?
Bubble wrap did not exist back then. And when you got that award, as gentleman's thing, you didn't enter the AD&D Open again. You see, there were some people who did and tried to win it every year, but it's like, no, I've done the AD&D Open, I've won it, right, that's it, I don't enter it ever again. I enter other events, but not that. So, you know, and I didn't play very often, but I DM'd a lot.
A lot of the freelancers today, one of the things that when we ask them the questions, have you ever played with so-and-so, they've done worlds, they've written stuff for them that have been created by other industry veterans, and a lot of things are saying, well, no, I never played with a guy. Actually, I've never played a game with anybody that I'm working with. This person, he's over there, and it's all by working from home, sending the manuscripts, and a lot of people don't play with each other. Do you think that's something that's changed in the industry, that the people who are writing for the RPGs sort of like don't really have any physical contact anymore? I mean, in the, you know, working and playing a game together, or just meeting at cons and things like that, or do you think that's changed, or is that...
It has changed, yes, because the internet has made it possible, and computer gaming has made it possible, because you can now... let me put it this way. When I was a little kid, playing with yourself had a different meaning than it does now, okay? Because there were no games that you could play against yourself, except on the most basic physical level of setting up the chessboard, making a move, then walking around the other side of the chessboard, or... If you were really, really rich, you bought a Lazy Susan, which is one of those little discs that turns at the table, and you'd turn the board around without getting up from your chair and then play the other side. But, I mean, you were trying to make games solitaire, and quite often you had to because you didn't have anybody who lived near you to play with. And that's why you made long journeys across town and whatever to show up at a gaming club. But now, increasingly, you can play online, and you can play an Xbox or a console or just a computer, a game on your computer, either with somebody around the world or against yourself or against the computer. So it's made it possible. And in the same way, as gaming has become a profession as opposed to a hobby, because when gaming started, everybody made stuff in their basement. And the sort of vendor's hall you see upstairs at this convention, which is huge and crammed, didn't exist. You had a few guys with card tables set up. You know, there weren't that many people in the industry, and there wasn't that much product out there, and there wasn't, and life was lived at a slower pace, and people could get together, and things happened by mail. And then around about the 1980s, FedEx was the big revolution. You could actually send boxes of stuff to each other, and literally I would get something from TSR at my workplace, the public library, a box, and I'd open it and would have, here, could you just make these corrections and then send it back in the envelope that we've enclosed in this box? So I would put it all back, I'd do the corrections, I'd phone FedEx, put it in the envelope, FedEx would pick it up the other end of the same day and take it away. And now, button on the keyboard, email, You know, so it's inevitable that that's changed. And the contact has shrunk somewhat. In some cases, it's because gaming is now more worldwide. I mean, it wasn't that it wasn't worldwide before, but it was so isolated that you never got to meet these other people. If people were wargaming or playing D&D in Australia, you only got to find out about it when somebody made the long journey. Now you can do it across the globe electronically. So yeah, inevitably it's happening. I think it's an inevitable change that I decry on one way because we don't get to game as much together face to face, but on the other way, you get input from all over the world now, and some of the worldviews that came that were narrower. Well, just for instance, somebody from the deep south in the United States of America may know all about the Confederate forces in the U.S. Civil War, but he may not know much about Canada. At my early conventions, I used to get asked seriously, not as a joke, but seriously, were the polar bears bad on my ride down? And I'd say, oh no, the Mounties held them off. We got these new things called skidoos now, you know, and stuff like that. And they'd believe me, you know, because there was this isolation. Now you get ideas from France, ideas from England, ideas from Germany, ideas from Australia, ideas from all over the world. And instead of having these fantasies of what's life like in exotic India, you can actually talk to somebody who was in, quote, exotic India 8 hours ago before he got on the plane. You know, so it does, you know.
You've mentioned a lot of things about you've played games, and of course, Gary, Dave Anderson, all these people, we're running games together. And do you think it's important, if you're writing for the gaming industry, to be a game master, to be running games? Or do you have to be good at being a good GM? Does that mean that you're going to be a good writer, or can you actually be a good writer? And, you know, I don't want the GM. I don't like GM. I just like creating work. Do you think it's imperative that you be able to be a good GM or not?
It's not imperative, I don't think. There will be some people who will never be good DMs, and there are some people who will never be good game designers, even though they might excel at the other thing, or they might like to do the other thing but not be very good at it. I do think it's important that people who design games do run the games, because you can have all sorts of screw-ups in the game that aren't apparent when you've written this beautifully polished, unfolding narrative. Looks so good. And then the first time you sit down at a gaming table, some guy says, but what about... And you didn't think of it. And it's not there in your rules. So doing the DMing, I think, makes for a better game. But that doesn't... You don't have to be a great DM to be a great game designer, and vice versa. It would be lovely if everybody could be, but, I mean, I've seen and worked with good writers who had physical disabilities that would mean they will never come across well as a dungeon master. They can't do the acting. They can't put on voices. They have a stutter, or they have an artificial voice box they're using. Okay, it just isn't the same thing as somebody who can wear costumes and leap around at the gaming table, who can put on silly voices for the Monty Python joke, or they can play a female character and sound like a female character. I mean, there will always be people who are great ham actors and at the same time are good DMs, because they can keep track of everything and keep the game flowing and keep everybody who's playing excited and interested and entertained. But I don't think you should try designing games or just world settings for games without ever playing and without dungeon mastering at least occasionally, because that's where you see where that's where the rubber hits the road and you see whether there's gaps in your design, problems. For instance, there was years and years ago when Descent into the Depths, when the Drow modules, the D modules and then the Q module, Queen of Demonwed Pits, were brand new. There was a seminar at Gen Con about how they designed it and how they changed some things. Well, they had one room early on when you were getting towards the Vault of the Drow. You went into this room and there were four pillars. Well, the four pillars were salamanders if you touched them. But nobody touched them. They just said, four pillars, nothing else in the room, and they left. You know? And so they said, oh, we had to take that out of the design because nobody ever touched the pillars. And I mean, okay, there is an example of how somebody dungeon mastering would correct somebody designing. And so, yeah, I think you should do both.
And to a lot of people who are now getting into the industry, what would you say is the way that they should go about getting to start writing for the gaming industry?
Oh dear, this is where I'm not sure if my advice applies anymore, because everything's changing so much. I would say the traditional way, the so-called front door, was to write for the gaming magazines, impress people, meet the designers and the companies at conventions, offer to write for them when you could already wave under their noses the articles you've already done, so they know that you understand the game, you can write and communicate, and you're a somewhat nice person, and you impress upon them when you meet them that you somewhat understand what deadlines are too, and therefore you can be of use to them. That's the front door. I don't know how effective things are anymore, because I'm already in, so to speak. I'm in the room. For someone like me, I see a lot of people who blog all the time about gaming, and I sometimes wonder, okay, there's a difference between blogging and having a presence and being lost in the blogosphere of everybody shouting, and there's also the regrettable tendency on the part of some people to review everything, and when they're reviewing things, to confuse what they like and dislike with what is good or bad. So they trash somebody because they don't like the person. So therefore, this game, which I haven't bothered to play or buy, or this novel, which I haven't bothered to buy or read, is going to be crappy because I hate that person. Or I hate something that person did 10 years ago. And it somewhat distresses me that people who set themselves up as to pontificate on gaming might see that as a way into the gaming field and get away with it or be successful at it. Whereas to me, that would just make me shudder, because I would think, no, surely you should learn that the world is bigger than what you like and don't like, and maybe something you hate could be good for somebody else or could work for somebody else. But aside from that, that's where I'm a little, I have some trepidation about giving advice. But in general, if you want to be any sort of creative, you have to give the audience what they want. And of course, your first audience for gaming is the editor at the gaming company, because if they don't buy it, the general public will never see it. Okay? Give it to them, give them what they want, give it to them on time with no hassles, and if they want changes, cheerfully make those changes and say yes sir and give them the changes right away, rather than trying to convince them that, you know, you're brilliant and they're just the guy who designed the game, that's all, and they should come around to your way of thinking, which to me is always like, the real world doesn't work that way, why would gaming? But in general, participate in gaming, write stuff, offer to write stuff. At the beginning, they don't know who you are. You're just one among thousands of gamers. Impress them with what you can write or design. Impress them with what you can GM for them at an event, at a con. And then say, hey, I really like, you know, if you're doing another edition of this game or you're doing an adventure, I'd love to work on it. You know, communicate that enthusiasm.
Now, you're one of the few people that probably can say that you've seen from the very early on editions of D&D, probably to what it is now. What are your comments on how it has evolved and where it's going? I mean, is it, for instance, when we interviewed Gary Gygax at this convention, I think it was over 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I was there. You were on the panel with him.
Yeah. He had mentioned, commented on third edition coming out, because back then third edition was coming out, replacing second edition, and it was a big thing. Now fourth edition is coming out, replacing third edition, and are coming out with a new version of fourth edition, which is basically looks like the old basic box, except now it has the Wizard Lore of
Essentials.
Essentials. Yeah. What are your thoughts on this revisionism, and do you think the game has improved? Is it, or has it just evolved, changed? What are your thoughts as someone who's seen everything, who's been there from the start?
The game is just different, and the game will always be different, because the game always has to be repackaged for a new generation of gamers. It isn't necessarily better or worse. It's just different. Now, what has happened is you've seen an evolution where the first edition of D&D gamers were gamers. They had already played war games, sand table war games, whether they actually had sand on their tables or not. Games with little miniatures, and you measured things, and you moved, and they were used to that. Then they caught on at college campuses. I'm talking the original D&D, and it was something you could play sitting around a littered college dorm room or frat with your friends. Everybody sprawled. You didn't need the table. You didn't need the miniatures. You were telling a story. And successive versions of the game have made the game more accessible to non-gamers or to people who've never played a role-playing game before. I mean, one of the big hurdles for us at the beginning, even though we had the dungeon game in various, and it has evolved too, the dungeon board game I'm talking now, how do you learn how to play D&D the first time? Well, the best way was to sit down with somebody who already played D&D and sit in on it. Because if you actually bought the thing from the word go and you weren't a gamer and you tried to learn how to play it, forget it. You know, there was so much to, you know. So each successive version of the game has tried to make the game more accessible to non-gamers. And then those most recent edition, the fourth edition, make it accessible to people who are gamers of a different sort, computer gamers, who have played online, who have played against console machines, who are used to first-person shooters and so on like that, who are used to fantasy in their culture, because it's now, quote, almost mainstream. They can go to a theater and see Lord of the Rings. They can see Avatar. This is stuff that would have not been accessible in most movie theaters earlier, because fantasy was that weird stuff that only certain... Fantasy and science fiction, too. They were very few movies. They didn't have the budget to do good special effects and didn't know how, usually. And they had a niche audience. So the game is always changing. And now the game is owned by a corporation that is looking to see how the game is responding to its audience and how we can get a new audience. And there's that difficult saw-off between how do you get your new audience without alienating your old audience? You know, if I'm going to jump out of the boat that we already have to try and get those people over there, am I going to sink the boat that I'm leaving? You know, it's a difficult thing. But each attempt to rewrite the game is an attempt to fix perceived flaws or problems with the earlier version, like rules that don't work. And also to repackage the game so it will become new and exciting to new people. Because now, again, with the corporation involved, they're looking to have a new audience come in. This is because toy companies like Hasbro, who owns Wizards of the Coast, like Mattel, there's a new crop of kids always coming along. Now, do the new crop of kids want to play the exact same game their parents and grandparents play? Maybe so, at the cottage and so on, and some of those games exist. There are nostalgia versions of Monopoly and so on that you can buy. But there's also the, how do we get the new kids interested? Won't they be interested in something new that's all their own? You know, and there have been things that came out of nowhere, like Harry Potter came out of nowhere. Okay, so that's something new to a new generation. People who are already into fantasy look at it and say, but that's the English school story put together with, yeah, we've seen that. But it's new to these people, and it's their thing. They're into it. So you do a game to go with it. Well, okay, the same way, Dungeons & Dragons is going to keep changing over the years. It's going to be repackaged. It's not necessarily better or worse, because what works, what's best, is what's best for your gaming table. My players use second edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, you know, the books. They've never really moved on because they don't need rules anymore. We just role play. They occasionally read some of the new stuff to get ideas, and I don't mean gaming ideas. I mean the cool illustrations will make them think of something like, oh, isn't that a beautiful skyship sailing through those skies? And that's neat. I'd love to do an adventure like that sort of thing. They use it as an idea thing. They don't say, oh, I have to change all the rules I play by, because no, they don't. We play with the same rules we've always played with. So it's what works for your gaming table. So you can't say one version of the game is better than another or not. But you can say that each successive edition of the game has tried to fix errors with the previous ones. Rules that didn't work. Things that were, quote, broken in gaming parlance.
Now, the new game, do you think that the role-playing aspect is just as big as it used to be in the old game, or the older editions of D&D, or is the role-playing aspect something that you should have to bring into the book? I mean, just an example, the rule books, as they are in the fourth edition, they're very collections of just spells and abilities and so on. And to some extent, all editions of D&D were like this. But there's some people out there that feel that the new edition is basically just about combat miniatures and encounters. And where's the role-playing in that? And is it just a war game that has a little bit of role-playing? Is it true? What are your thoughts on that, the role-playing aspect of 4th Ed? If I were a player taking the 4th edition of D&D, would I necessarily role-play the same way as if I was somebody in the 70s playing the original 1st edition D&D?
Definitely not. Because in the 70s, the original D&D, everybody was flawed. That's why you had character classes. You know, your fighter couldn't heal. You know, your fighter couldn't even touch some of the monsters that needed magic to touch them, or magic weapons. Your fighter couldn't successfully pick a lock and creep up on somebody from behind. You know, so you had a thief for that. They were specialized character classes that forced cooperation. Cooperation, not necessarily role-play. So the earlier edition of the game would have had to be played differently because it forced the character classes, forced people to work together in groups. Whereas increasingly, the fourth edition of the game, everybody can do everything to some extent. So everybody's more well-rounded. The min-maxing, as we used to call it, that goes on it's to the ultimate. Everybody can build the ultimate character. But therefore, enforced role-playing isn't built into the game as strongly. But that's always been the case, actually, because the amount of actual role-playing you did at the table depended on everybody, the players and the DM, and what style they wanted to play or what style they evolved or hammered out between them. I have seen original D&D things back at Gen Con 8, and we're up past in the late 30s in Gen Con now, so that's how many years have passed, where people sat around saying, with their rule books in front of them at the playing table, reading the spells and saying, well, it says here that the Blade Bearer does this, so Cleric, why don't you cast the Blade Bearer in front of him, and then I'll hit him from behind with this, and then see if you sneak around behind and backstab him. You know, they're playing it like a quarterback, a football quarterback. And yeah, there are other people at the same convention, sitting at a table not too far away, where everybody is speaking as their character. Roll on, run and strike him before the Blade Bearer. You know, they're speaking as their character, they're trying to act. And of course, the tolerance for that and the comfort for that depends on the group. So you've always had to decide it for yourselves. It's never been built in. What the rules did was force cooperation, and less so now. Because what they were trying to do, and if you talk to the designers of 4th edition, they will tell you, because they have in public, they've already said, well, we didn't want characters to have just one thing to do and then sit there with nothing else to do till the end of the round. The old, after the magic user, first level magic user casts his one spell, he stands there as holding a torch and being a target for the rest of the adventure until they sleep for so many hours he can get his one spell back. And don't put him in the front, because if he falls down the pit trap, he's dead. You know, it's that sort of thing. So they were, but the earlier editions of the game was forcing cooperation, but not necessarily better role play. So yeah, again, you see that there's not a simple answer to that.
Have you played 4th edition?
Yes, many times. In fact, Wizards of the Coast flew me to D&D Experience a couple years back when the Living Forgotten Realms was being launched in order to play 4th edition as a player, and I sat down and had a great time playing. We had a great DM. I really enjoyed it. It was a completely different play experience from playing earlier editions of the game. And it was a bit bumpy because everybody was learning. Like, for instance, that particular adventure was one of the inaugural adventures, and it had a row of skill challenges, so everybody could try using skill challenges. You know, so it changed the mood from what you would have done at a gaming table if you were acting, because everybody would step out of character, and the dungeon master would say, okay, now if you try this, I'll need you to roll a this check, and if you try that, I'll need you to... So they were stepping out of the style of role-playing. But that didn't make it worse, it just made it different. No.
So, we've touched a lot of things, or discussed many, many things. Do you have any general comments about, you know, the industry, role-playing, anything you'd like to share with our readers and our listeners?
Well, as a general comment, I just say, live your life to the fullest. You could be dead tomorrow. Every day could be your last. I'm not saying, you know, live your life in fear. I'm saying, don't put off doing things or trying things today because, oh, I'll get to that tomorrow. So if a good-looking fantasy book or science fiction book catches your eye in the library or at a bookstore, have a look. At least open it. You know, even if you don't buy it and take it home, at least open it. Have a look. Your life is now. Your life isn't tomorrow. We're living in the now. Same thing with gaming. If you go to a convention, you'll get to see how many weird other people play games and wear costumes too, and you won't be alone anymore. You'll know that there are thousands like you, and try all those games. Look at the games. If there's demos or seminars, sit in on them. You know, that's what they're there for. Don't just go to a convention to play with the same group of people every year and do the same things. Try something new. Have a look at everything. This gaming is now too big. Just like fantasy novels are too big, comics are too big, science fiction novels are too big, science fiction movies are too big, anime is too big for one person to keep up with it all. But you've only yourself to blame if you die never having tried that wine, never having eaten a steak dinner, never having gone out into the jungle, never having ridden a horse. Same way with all these things. Try them all. Taste everything in the genre. Look at everything. See what you like. Don't necessarily follow the herd. Try everything, because that's what this hobby is all about. It's all this lovely creative stuff that people are creating stuff for you. You know, jump out there, jump into it. Try it. It's great.
Well, that was Ed Greenwood at Fan Expo. Thank you, Ed, for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to the Dicecast. We hope you enjoyed it. We look forward to hearing your comments, recommendations, or opinions. Just write to us at our email address at dicecast@polymancer.com. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this segment. You can find out more about who we are and what we do at our website, www.polymancer.com, as well as our main corporate website, www.polymancerstudios.com. You can also keep in touch with us by emailing us directly at dicecast@polymancerstudios.com, follow us on Twitter at Polymancer, on Facebook at facebook.com/polymancer, and myspace.com/polymancer. The music for this segment, Fort Minor, Remember the Name BYFH Remix by Chojin, Violated Instrumental by Technetium, Industrial March Beat and Triple Layer Guitar in E by Neurowax are all released under a Creative Commons license. This episode is copyright 2010 Polymancer Studios Incorporated, released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works license, the full text of which is available at creativecommons.org. This episode may be copied or redistributed so long as it is done free of charge in unmodified form and due credit is given to the copyright owner. Dicecast is a trademark of Polymancer Studios Incorporated. The word Polymancer is a registered trademark of Polymancer Studios Incorporated. Thank you for listening to the Dicecast.